Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Emily of New Moon. Beloved for her iconic role as Miss Stacy in the classic television series Anne of Green Gables, celebrated Canadian actress Marilyn Lightstone now returns to the world of Lucy Maud Montgomery and the magic of Prince Edward Island to bring to life the unforgettable coming-of-age story of the imaginative young heroine Emily Starr. If this is your first time joining us, you can find all episodes of Marilyn Lightstone Reads at classicalfm.ca or on your favorite podcast app. And now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Emily of New Moon.
Chapter 17. Living Epistles.
Dear Father, I have such an exciting thing to tell you. I have been the heroine of an adventure. One day last week, Ilsa asked me if I would go and stay all night with her, because her father was away and wouldn't be home till very late, and Ilsa said she wasn't frightened but very lonesome. So I asked Aunt Elizabeth if I could. I hardly dared hope, dear Father, that she would let me, for she doesn't approve of little girls being away from home at night. But to my surprise, she said I could go very kindly. And then I heard her say in the pantry to Aunt Laura, "It is a shame the way the doctor leaves that poor child so much alone at nights. It is wicked of him." And Aunt Laura said, "The poor man is warped. You know, he was not a bit like that before his wife." And then, just as it was getting interesting, Aunt Elizabeth gave Aunt Laura a nudge and said, "Shh, little pitchers have big ears." Well, I know she meant me, though my ears are not big, only pointed. I do wish I could find out what Ilsa's mother did. It worries me after I go to bed. I lie awake for ever so long thinking about it. Ilsa has no idea. Once she asked her father, and he told her, in a voice of thunder, never to mention that woman to him again. And there is something else that worries me, too. I keep thinking of Silas Lee, who killed his brother at the old well. How dreadful the poor man must have felt. And what is it to be warped? I went over to Ilsa's, and we played in the garret. I like playing there because we don't have to be careful and tidy like we do in our garret. Ilsa's garret is very untidy, and can't have been dusted for years. The rag room is worse than the rest. It is boarded off at one end of the garret, and it is full of old clothes and bags of rags and broken furniture. Well, I don't like the smell of it. The kitchen chimney goes up through it, and things hang round it, or did. For all this is in the past now, dear Father. When we got tired playing, we sat down on an old chest and talked. "This is splendid in daytime," I said, "but it must be awful queer at night." "Mice," said Ilsa, "and spiders and ghosts." "Well, I don't believe in ghosts," I said scornfully. "There isn't any such thing." "But maybe there is for all that, dear Father." "I believe this garret is haunted," said Ilsa. "They say garrets always are." "Well, nonsense," I said. "You know, dear Father, it would not do for a new moon person to believe in ghosts. But I felt very queer." "It's easy to talk," said Ilsa, beginning to be mad, although I wasn't trying to run down her garret. "But you wouldn't stay here alone at night." "I wouldn't mind it a bit," I said. "Then I dare you to do it," said Ilsa. "I dare you to come up here at bedtime and sleep here all night." Then I saw I was in an awful scrape, Father dear. It is a foolish thing to boast. I knew not what to do. It was dreadful to think of sleeping alone in that garret. But if I didn't, Ilsa would always cast it up to me whenever we fought. And worse than that, she would tell Teddy, and he would think me a coward. So I said proudly, "I'll do it, Ilsa Burnley, and I'm not afraid to either." But, I was inside. "The mice will run over you," said Ilsa. "Oh, I wouldn't be you for the world." Well, it was mean of Ilsa to make things worse than they were. But I could feel she admired me too, and that helped me a great deal. We dragged an old feather bed out of the rag room, and Ilsa gave me a pillow and half her clothes. It was dark by this time, and Ilsa wouldn't go up into the garret again. So I said my prayers very carefully, and then I took a lamp and started up. I'm so used to candles now that the lamp made me nervous. Ilse said I looked scared to death. My knees shook, dear father. But for the honour of the stars, and the Murrays too, I went on. I had undressed in Ilse's room, so I got right into bed and blew out the lamp. But I couldn't go to sleep for a long time. The moonlight made the garret look weird. I don't know exactly what weird means, but I feel the garret was it. The bags and old clothes hanging from the beams looked like creatures. I thought, I need not be frightened. The angels are here. But then, I felt as if I would be as much frightened of angels as of anything else, and I could hear rats and mice scrambling over things. I thought, what if a rat was to run over me? And then I thought that next day I would write out a description of the garret by moonlight and my feelings. At last, I heard the doctor driving in, and then I heard him knocking round in the kitchen, and I felt better. And before very long, I went to sleep, and I dreamed a dreadful dream. I dreamed the door of the rag room opened, and a big newspaper came out and chased me all round the garret. And then it went on fire, and I could smell the smoke plain as plain, and it was just on me when I screamed, and I woke up. I was sitting right up in bed, and the newspaper was gone. But I could smell smoke still. I looked at the rag room door, and smoke was coming out under it, and I saw firelight through the cracks of the boards. I just yelled at the top of my voice and tore down to Ilse's room, and she rushed across the hall and woke her father. He said, "Damn!" But he got right up, and then all three of us kept running up and down the garret stairs with pails of water, and we made an awful mess. But we got the fire out. It was just the bags of wool that had been hanging close to the chimney that had caught fire. When all was over, the doctor wiped the perspiration from his manly brow and said, "That was a close call. A few minutes later would have been too late. I put on a fire when I came in to make a cup of tea, and I suppose those bags must have caught fire from a spark. I see there's a hole here where the plaster has tumbled out. I must have this whole place cleaned out. How in the world did you come to discover the fire, Emily?" "I was sleeping in the garret," I said. "Sleeping in the garret?" said the doctor. What were you doing there?" "Well, Ilse dared me," I said. "She said I'd be too scared to stay there, and I said I wouldn't. I fell asleep and woke up and smelled smoke."
"You little devil," said the doctor.
I suppose it was a dreadful thing to be called a devil, but the doctor looked at me so admiringly that I felt as if he was paying me a compliment. Yes, queer ways of talking. Ilse says the only time he ever said a kind thing to her was once when she had a sore throat. He called her a poor little animal and looked as if he was sorry for her. I feel sure Ilse feels dreadfully bad because her father doesn't like her, though she pretends she doesn't care. But, oh, dear father, there is more to tell. Yesterday, the Shrewsbury Weekly Times came, and in the Blair notes, it told all about the fire at the doctor's and said it had been fortunately discovered in time by Miss Emily Starr. I cannot tell you what I felt like when I saw my name in the paper. I felt famous, and I never was called Miss in earnest before. Last Saturday, Aunt Elizabeth and Aunt Laura went to Shrewsbury for the day and left Cousin Jimmy and me to keep house. We had such fun, and Cousin Jimmy let me skim all the milk pans. But after dinner, unexpected company came, and there was no cake in the house. That was a dreadful thing. It never happened before in the annals of New Moon. Aunt Elizabeth had toothache all day yesterday, and Aunt Laura was away at Priest Pond visiting Great Aunt Nancy, so no cake was made. I prayed about it, and then I went to work and made a cake by Aunt Laura's recipe, and it turned out all right. Cousin Jimmy helped me set the table and get supper, and I poured the tea and never slopped any over in the saucers. You would have been so proud of me, Father. Mrs. Lewis took a second piece of cake and said I would know Elizabeth Murray's cake if I found it in Central Africa. I said not a word for the honour of the family. but I felt very proud. I had saved the Murrays from disgrace. When Aunt Elizabeth came home and heard the tale, she looked grim and tasted a piece that was left, and then she said, "Well, you have got some Murray in you anyway." That is the first time Aunt Elizabeth has ever praised me. She had 3 teeth out, so they will not ache any more. I am glad for her sake. Before I went to bed, I got the cookbook and picked out all the things I'd like to make. Queen pudding, sea foam sauce, black-eyed Susans, pigs in blankets. Oh, they all sound just lovely. I can see such beautiful, fluffy white clouds over lofty John's bush. I wish I could soar up and drop right into them. I can't believe they would be wet and messy like Teddy says. Teddy cut my initials and his together on the monarch of the forest, but somebody has cut them out. I don't know whether it was Perry or Ilsa. Miss Brownell hardly ever gives me good deportment marks now, and Aunt Elizabeth is much displeased on Friday nights, but Aunt Laura understands. I wrote an account of the afternoon when Miss Brownell made fun of my poems and put it in an old envelope and wrote Aunt Elizabeth's name on it and put it among my papers. If I die of consumption, Aunt Elizabeth will find it and know the rights of it and mourn that she was so unjust to me. But I don't think I will die, because I'm getting much fatter, and Ilsa told me she had heard her father tell Aunt Laura I would be handsome if I had more color. Is it wrong to want to be handsome, dearest father? Aunt Elizabeth says it is, and when I said to her, "Wouldn't you like to be handsome, Aunt Elizabeth?" she seemed annoyed about something. Miss Brownell has had a spite at Perry ever since that evening, and treats him very mean. But he is meek, and says he won't kick up any fuss in school because he wants to learn and get ahead. He keeps saying his rhymes are as good as mine, and I know they are not, and it exasperates me. If I do not pay attention all the time in school, Miss Brownell says, "I suppose you are composing poetry, Emily," and then everybody laughs. No, not everybody. I must not exaggerate. Teddy and Perry and Ilsa and Jenny never laugh. It is funny that I like Jenny so well now, and I hated her so that first day in school. Her eyes are not piggy after all. They are small, but they are jolly and twinkly. She's quite popular in school. I do hate Frank Barker. He took my new reader and wrote in a big sprawly way all over the front page, "Steal not this book for fear of shame, for on it is the owner's name. And when you die, the Lord will say, 'Where is that book you stole away?' And when you say you do not know, the Lord will say, 'Go down below.'" That is not a refined poem, and besides, it is not the right way to speak about God. I tore out the leaf and burned it, and Aunt Elizabeth was very angry, and even when I explained why, her wrath was not appeased. Ilsa says she is going to call God Allah after this. I think it is a nicer name myself. It's so soft and doesn't sound so stern. But I fear it's not religious enough. May 20th. Yesterday was my birthday, dear father. It will soon be a year since I came to New Moon. I feel as if I'd always lived here. I have grown 2 inches. Cousin Jimmy measured me by a mark on the dairy door. My birthday was very nice. Aunt Laura made a lovely cake and gave me a beautiful new white petticoat with an embroidered flounce. She had run a blue ribbon through it, but Aunt Elizabeth made her pull it out. And Aunt Laura also gave me that piece of pink satin brocade in her bureau drawer. I have longed for it ever since I saw it, but never hoped to possess it. Ilsa asked me what I meant to do with it, but I don't mean to do anything with it, only keep it up here in the garret with my treasures and look at it because it is beautiful. Aunt Elizabeth gave me a dictionary. That was a useful present. I feel I ought to like it. You will soon notice an improvement in my spelling, I hope. The only trouble is, When I am writing something interesting, I get so excited. It is just awful to have to stop and hunt up a word to see how it is spelled. I looked up ween in it, and Miss Brownell was right. I did not know what it really meant. It rhymed so well with sheen, and I thought it meant to behold or see, but it means to think. Cousin Jimmy gave me a big, thick, blank book. I am so proud of it. It'll be so nice to write pieces in. But I will still use the letter bills to write to you, dear father, because I can fold each one up by itself and address it like a real letter. Teddy gave me a picture of myself. He painted it in watercolors and called it The Smiling Girl. I look as if I was listening to something that made me very happy. Ilsa says it flatters me. It does make me better looking than I am, but not any better looking than I would be if I could have a bang. Teddy says he is going to paint a real big picture of me when he grows up. Perry walked all the way to Shrewsbury to get me a necklace of pearl beads and lost it. He had no more money, so we went home to Stovepipe Town and got a young hen from his Aunt Tom and gave me that. He is a very persistent boy. I am to have all the eggs the hen lays to sell the peddler for myself. Ilsa gave me a box of candy. I am only going to eat one piece a day to make it last a long time. I wanted Ilsa to eat some, but she said she wouldn't because it would be mean to help eat a present you had given, and I insisted, and then we fought over it, and Ilsa said I was a caterwauling quadruped, which was ridiculous, and didn't know enough to come in when it rained. And I said I knew enough to have some manners at least. But Ilsa got so mad she went home, but she cooled off soon and came back for supper. It is raining tonight, and it sounds like fairies' feet dancing over the garret roof. If it had not rained, Teddy was going to come down and help me look for the lost diamond. Oh, wouldn't it be splendid if we could find it? Cousin Jimmy is fixing up the garden. He lets me help him, and I have a little flower bed of my own. I always run out first thing every morning to see how much the things have grown since yesterday. Spring is such a happifying time, isn't it, Father? The little blue people are all out round the summer house. That is what Cousin Jimmy calls the violets, and I think it's lovely. He has names like that for all the flowers. The roses are the queens, and the June lilies are the snow ladies, and the tulips are the gay folk, and the daffodils are the golden ones, and the china asters are my pink friends. Mike the second is here with me, sitting on the windowsill. Mike is a Smee cat. Smee is not in the dictionary. It's a word I invented myself. I could not think of any English word which just describes Mike the second, so I made this up. It means sleek and glossy and soft and fluffy, all in one, and something else besides that I can't express. Aunt Laura is teaching me to sew. She says I must learn to make a hem on muslin that can't be seen. Tradition. I hope she will teach me how to make point lace someday. All the Murrays of New Moon have been noted for making point lace. I mean all the women Murrays. None of the girls in school can make point lace. Aunt Laura says she will make me a point lace handkerchief when I get married. All the New Moon brides had point lace handkerchiefs except my mother, who ran away. But you didn't mind her not having one, did you, Father? Aunt Laura talks a good bit about my mother to me, but not when Aunt Elizabeth is around. Aunt Elizabeth never mentions her name. Aunt Laura wants to show me Mother's room, but she has never been able to find the key yet, because Aunt Elizabeth keeps it hid. Aunt Laura says Aunt Elizabeth loved my mother very much. You would think she would love her daughter some, wouldn't you? But she doesn't. She is just bringing me up as a duty. June the 1st. Dear Father, this has been a very important day. I wrote my first letter. I mean, the first letter that was really to go in the mail. It was to Great Aunt Nancy, who lives at Priest Pond, and who is very old. She wrote Aunt Elizabeth and said I might write now and then to a poor old woman. My heart was touched, and I wanted to. Aunt Elizabeth said we might as well let her, and she said to me, "You must be careful to write a nice letter, and I will read it over when it is written. If you make a good impression on Aunt Nancy, she may do something for you." Well, I wrote the letter very carefully, but it didn't sound a bit like me when it was finished. I couldn't write a good letter when I knew Aunt Elizabeth was going to read it. I felt paralyzed. "Dear Father, my letter did not make a good impression on Great Aunt Nancy. She did not answer it, but she wrote Aunt Elizabeth that I must be a very stupid child to write such a stupid letter. I feel insulted, because I'm not stupid. Perry says he feels like going to Priest Pond and knocking the daylights out of Great Aunt Nancy. I told him he must not talk like that about my family. And anyhow, I don't see how knocking the daylights out of Great Aunt Nancy would make her change her opinion about me being stupid. I wonder what daylights are, and how you knock them out of people. I have 3 cantos of The White Lady finished. I have the heroine immured in a convent, and I don't know how to get her out because I'm not a Catholic. I suppose it would have been better if I had a Protestant heroine, but there were no Protestants in the days of chivalry. I might have asked Lofty John last year, but this year I can't because I've never spoken to him since he played that horrid joke on me about the apple. When I meet him on the road, I look straight ahead, just as lofty as he does. I have called my pig after him to get square. Cousin Jimmy has given me a little pig for my own. When it is sold, I am to have the money. I mean to give some for missionaries and put the rest in the bank to go to my education. And I thought if I ever had a pig, I would call it Uncle Wallace. But now it does not seem to me proper to call pigs after your uncles, even if you don't like them. Teddy and Perry and Ilsa and I play we are living in the days of chivalry, and Ilsa and I are distressed damsels rescued by gallant knights. Teddy made a splendid suit of armor out of old barrel staves, and then Perry made a better one out of old tin boilers hammered flat with a broken saucepan for a helmet. Sometimes we play at the tansy patch. I have a queer feeling that Teddy's mother hates me this summer. Last summer she just didn't like me. Smoke and Buttercup are not there now. They disappeared mysteriously in the winter. Teddy says he feels sure his mother poisoned them because she thought he was getting too fond of them. Teddy is teaching me to whistle, but Aunt Laura says it is unladylike. So many jolly things seem to be unladylike. Sometimes I almost wish my aunts were infidels like Dr. Burnley. He never bothers whether Ilsa is unladylike or not. But no, it would not be good manners to be an infidel. It would not be a new moon tradition. Today I taught Perry that he must not eat with his knife. He wants to learn all the rules of etiquette, and I am helping him learn a recitation for school examination day. I wanted Ilsa to do it, but she was mad because he asked me first, and she wouldn't. But she should, because she is a far better reciter than I am. I am too nervous. June 14th. Dear Father, we have composition in school now. Miss Brownell is sarcastic, but she does teach you things. I am putting that down because I want to be fair, even if I do hate her. And she is interesting, although she is not nice. I have written a description of her on a letter bill. I like writing about people I don't like better than about those who I do like. Aunt Laura is nicer to live with than Aunt Elizabeth, but Aunt Elizabeth is nicer to write about. I can describe her faults, but I feel wicked and ungrateful if I say anything that is not complimentary about dear Aunt Laura. Aunt Elizabeth has locked your books away and says I'm not to have them until I'm grown up, just as if I wouldn't be careful of them, dear Father. She says I wouldn't because she found that when I was reading one of them, I put a tiny pencil dot under every beautiful word. It didn't hurt the book a bit, dear Father. Some of the words were dingles, pearled, musk, dappled, intervales, glen, bosky, piping, shimmer, crisp, beechen, ivory. I think those are all lovely words, Father. Aunt Laura lets me read her copy of A Pilgrim's Progress on Sundays. I call the big hill in the road to White Cross the Delectable Mountain because it is such a beautiful one. Teddy lent me 3 books of poetry. One of them was Tennyson, and I have learned the bugle song off by heart, so I will always have it. One was Mrs. Browning. Oh, she is lovely. I would like to meet her. I suppose I will when I die, but that may be a long time away. The other was just one poem called Sohrab and Rustum. After I went to bed, I cried over it. Aunt Elizabeth said, "What are you sniffing about?" I wasn't sniffling. I was weeping sore. She made me tell her, and then she said, "You must be crazy." But I couldn't go to sleep until I had thought out a different end for it. A happy one. June 25th. Dear Father, there has been a dark shadow over this day. I dropped my scent in church. It made a dreadful noise, and I felt as if everybody looked at me. Aunt Elizabeth was much annoyed. Perry dropped his, too, soon after. He told me after church he did it on purpose because he thought it would make me feel better. But it didn't, because I was afraid the people would think it was me dropping mine again. Oh, boys do such queer things. I hope the minister did not hear, because I'm beginning to like him. I never liked him much before last Tuesday. His family are all boys, and I suppose he doesn't understand little girls very well. Then he called at New Moon. Aunt Laura and Aunt Elizabeth were both away, and I was in the kitchen alone. Mr. Dare came in and sat down on Saucy Sal, who was asleep in the rocking chair. He was comfortable, but Saucy Sal wasn't. He didn't sit on her stomach. If he had, I suppose he would have killed her. He just sat on her legs and tail. Sal yowled, but Mr. Dare is a little deaf and didn't hear her, and I was too shy to tell him. But Cousin Jimmy came in just as he was asking me if I knew my catechism and said, "Catechism, is it? Lawful heart, man. Listen to that poor dumb beast. Get up if you're a Christian." So Mr. Dare got up and said, "Dear me, this is very remarkable. I thought I felt something moving." I thought I would write this to you, dear Father, because it struck me as humorous. When Mr. Dare finished asking me questions, I thought it was my turn, and I would ask him some about some things I'd wanted to know for years. I asked him if he thought God was very particular about every little thing I did, and if he thought my cats would go to heaven. He said he hoped I never did wrong things, and that animals had no souls. And I asked him why we shouldn't put new wine in old bottles. Aunt Elizabeth does with her dandelion wine, and the old bottles do just as well as new ones. He explained quite kindly that the Bible bottles were made of skins and got rotten when they were old. It made it quite clear to me. Then I told him I was worried because I knew I ought to love God better than anything, but there were things I loved better than God. He said, "What things?" And I said, "Flowers and stars and the Wind Woman and the 3 princesses and things like that." And he smiled and said, "But they are just part of God, Emily. Every beautiful thing is." And all at once, I liked him ever so much and didn't feel shy with him anymore. He preached a sermon on heaven last Sunday. It seemed like a dull place. I think it must be more exciting than that. I wonder what I will do when I go to heaven, since I can't sing. I wonder if they will let me write poetry. But I think church is interesting. Aunt Elizabeth and Aunt Laura always read their Bibles before the service begins, but I like to stare around and see everybody and wonder what they're thinking of. It's so nice to hear the silk dresses swishing up the aisles. Bustles are very fashionable now, but Aunt Elizabeth will not wear them. I think Aunt Elizabeth would look funny with a bustle. Aunt Laura wears a very little one. Your lovingest daughter, Emily B. Starr. P.S. Dear Father, it is lovely to write to you, but oh, I never get an answer back.
E.B.S. Chapter 18. Father Cassidy. Consternation reigned at New Moon. Everybody was desperately unhappy. Aunt Laura cried. Aunt Elizabeth was so cantankerous that there was no living with her. Cousin Jimmy went about as one distracted, and Emily gave up worrying about Ilse's mother and Silas Lee's remorseful ghost after she went to bed, and worried over this new trouble. For it had all originated in her disregard of New Moon tradition in making calls on Lofty John, and Aunt Elizabeth did not mince matters in telling her so. If she, Emily Bird Starr, had never gone to Lofty John's, she would never have eaten the big sweet apple. And if she had never eaten the big sweet apple, Lofty John would not have played a joke on her. And if he had not played a joke on her, Aunt Elizabeth would never have gone and said bitter Murray-like things to him. And if Aunt Elizabeth had never said bitter Murray-like things to him, Lofty John would not have become offended and revengeful. And if Lofty John had not become offended and revengeful, he would never have taken it into his lofty head to cut down the beautiful grove to the north of New Moon. For this was exactly where this house that Jack built progression had landed them all. Lofty John had announced publicly in the Blairwater blacksmith shop that he was going to cut down the bush as soon as harvest was over. Every last tree and sapling was to be laid low. The news was promptly carried to New Moon and upset the inhabitants thereof as they had not been upset for years. In their eyes, it was nothing short of a catastrophe. Elizabeth and Laura could hardly bring themselves to believe it. The thing was incredible. That big, thick, protecting bush of spruce and hardwood had always been there. It belonged to New Moon morally. Even Lofty John Sullivan would not dare to cut it down. But Lofty John had an uncomfortable reputation for doing what he said he would do. That was a part of his loftiness. And if he did... New Moon will be ruined, wailed poor Aunt Laura. It will look dreadful. All its beauty will go, and we will be left open to the north wind and the sea storms. We have always been so warm and sheltered here. And Jimmy's garden will be ruined, too. This is what comes of bringing Emily here, said Aunt Elizabeth. It was a cruel thing to say. Even when all allowances were made, cruel and unjust, since her own sharp tongue and Murray sarcasm had had quite as much to do with it as Emily. But she said it, and it pierced Emily to the heart with a pang that left a scar for years. Poor Emily did not feel as if she needed any additional anguish. She was already feeling so wretched that she could not eat or sleep. Elizabeth Murray, angry and unhappy as she was, slept soundly at nights, but beside her in the darkness. Afraid to move or turn, lay a slender little creature whose tears, stealing silently down her cheeks, could not ease her breaking heart. For Emily thought her heart was breaking. She couldn't go on living and suffering like this. Nobody could. Emily had lived long enough at New Moon for it to get pretty thoroughly into her blood. Perhaps it had even been born there. At any rate, when she came to it, she fitted into its atmosphere as a hand into a glove. She loved it as well as if she had lived there all her short life. Loved every stick and stone and tree and blade of grass about it, every nail in the old kitchen floor, every cushion of green moss on the dairy roof, every pink and white columbine that grew in the old orchard, every tradition of its history. To think of its beauty being in a large measure reft from it was agony to her. And to think of Cousin Jimmy's garden being ruined. Emily loved that garden almost as much as he did. Why, it was the pride of Cousin Jimmy's life that he could grow there plants and shrubs that would winter nowhere else in Prince Edward Island. If the northern shelter were removed, they would die. And to think of that beautiful bush itself being cut down, The Today Road and the Yesterday Road and the Tomorrow Road being swept out of existence. The stately monarch of the forest discrowned. The little playhouse where she and Ilse had such glorious hours destroyed. The whole lovely, ferny, intimate place torn out of her life at one fell swoop. Oh, Lofty John had chosen and timed his vengeance well. When would the blow fall? Every morning Emily listened miserably as she stood on the sandstone doorstep of the kitchen for the sound of axe blows on the clear September air. Every evening when she returned from school, she dreaded to see that the work of destruction had begun. She pined and fretted. There were times when it seemed to her she couldn't bear her life any longer. Every day Aunt Elizabeth said something imputing the whole blame to her, and the child grew morbidly sensitive about it. Almost she wished Lofty John would begin and be done with it. If Emily had ever heard the classic story of Damocles, she would have heartily sympathized with him. If she had had any hope that it would do any good, she would have swallowed Murray pride and Star pride and every other kind of pride and gone on her knees to Lofty John to entreat him to hold his revengeful hand. But she believed it would not. Lofty John had left no doubt in anybody's mind as to his bitter determination in the matter. There was much talk about it in Blair Water, and some were very well pleased at this blow to New Moon pride and prestige. And some held that it was low and unclean behavior on Lofty John's part. And all agreed that this was what they had prophesied all along as bound to happen some day, when the old Murray-Sullivan feud of three generations should have come to its inevitable head. The only surprising thing was that Lofty John hadn't done it long ago. He had always hated Elizabeth Murray since their school days, when her tongue had not spared him. One day, by the banks of Blair Water, Emily sat down and wept. She had been sent to trim the dead blossoms off the rose bushes on Grandmother Murray's grave. Having finished her task, she had not the heart to go back to the house, where Aunt Elizabeth was making everybody miserable because she was herself so unhappy. Perry had reported that Lofty John had stated the day before at the blacksmith's that he was going to begin cutting down the big bush on Monday morning. "I can't bear it," sobbed Emily to the rose bushes. A few late roses nodded at her. The wind woman combed and waved and stirred the long green grasses on the graves, where proud Murrays, men and women, slept calmly, unstirred by old feuds and passions. The September sunlight shone beyond on old harvest fields, mellowly bright and serene, and very softly against its green, shrub-hung bank purred and lapped the blue Blair Water. "I don't see why God doesn't stop Lofty John," said Emily passionately. "Surely the New Moon Murrays had a right to expect that much from Providence." Teddy came whistling down the pasture, the notes of his tune blowing across the Blair Water like elfin drops of sound, vaulted the graveyard fence, and perched his lean, graceful body irreverently on the "Here I Stay" of Great-Grandmother Murray's flat tombstone. "What's the matter?" he said.
"Everything's the matter," said Emily, a little crossly.
Teddy had no business to be looking so cheerful. She was used to more sympathy from Teddy, and it aggravated her not to find it.
"Don't you know Lofty John is going to begin cutting down the bush Monday?"
Teddy nodded.
"Yep, Ilse told me. But look here, Emily, I've thought of something. Lofty John wouldn't dare cut down that bush if the priest told him not to, would he?"
"Why?" "Because the Catholics have to do just what their priests tell them to, haven't they?"
"I don't know. I don't know anything about them. We are Presbyterians."
Emily gave her head a little toss. Mrs. Kent was known to be an English church woman, and though Teddy went to the Presbyterian Sunday school, that fact gave him scanty standing among bread-in-the-bone Presbyterian circles.
If your Aunt Elizabeth went to Father Cassidy at Whitecross and asked him to stop Lofty John, maybe he'd do it, persisted Teddy. Aunt Elizabeth would never do that, said Emily positively. I'm sure of it. She's too proud. Not even to save the bush. Not even for that. Then I guess nothing can be done, said Teddy, rather crestfallen. Look here. See what I've made. This is a picture of Lofty John in purgatory, with three little devils sticking red-hot pitchforks into him. I copied some of it out of one of Mother's books. Dante's Infernal, I think it was. But I put Lofty John in place of the man in the book. You can have it. I don't want it. Emily uncoiled her legs and got up. She was past the stage when inflicting imaginary torments on Lofty John could comfort her. She had already slain him in several agonizing ways during her night vigils. But an idea had come to her. A daring, breathless idea. I must go home now, Teddy. It's supper time. Teddy pocketed his despised sketch, which was really a wonderful bit of work, if either of them had had the sense to know it. The expression of anguish in Lofty John's face as a merry little devil touched him up with a pitchfork would have been the despair of many a trained artist. He went home wishing he could help Emily. It was all wrong that a creature like Emily, with soft purple-gray eyes and a smile that made you think of all sorts of wonderful things you couldn't put into words, that she should be unhappy. Teddy felt so worried about it that he added a few more devils to his sketch of Lofty John in purgatory and lengthened the prongs of their pitchforks quite considerably. Emily went home with a determined twist to her mouth. She ate as much supper as she could, which wasn't much, for Aunt Elizabeth's face would have destroyed her appetite if she had had any, and then sneaked out of the house by the front door. Cousin Jimmy was working in his garden, but he did not call her. Cousin Jimmy was always very sorrowful now. Emily stood a moment on the Grecian porch and looked at Lofty John's bush, green-bosomed, waving, all lovely. Would it be a desecrated waste of stumps by Monday night? Goaded by the thought, Emily cast fear and hesitation to the winds and started briskly off down the lane. When she reached the gate, she turned to the left on the long red road of mystery that ran up the delectable mountain. She had never been on that road before. It ran straight to Whitecross. Emily was going to the parish house there to interview Father Cassidy. It was 2 miles to Whitecross, and Emily walked it all too soon. Not because it was a beautiful road of wind and wild fern, haunted by little rabbits, but because she dreaded what awaited her at the end. She had been trying to think what she should say, how she should say it, but her invention failed her. She had no acquaintance with Catholic priests, and couldn't imagine how you should talk to them at all. They were even more mysterious and unknowable than ministers. Suppose Father Cassidy should be dreadfully angry at her daring to come there and ask a favor? Perhaps it was a dreadful thing to do from every point of view. And very likely it would do no good. Very likely Father Cassidy would refuse to interfere with Lofty John, who was a good Catholic, while she was, in his opinion, a heretic. But for any chance, even the faintest, of averting the calamity impending over New Moon, Emily would have faced the entire sacred college. Horribly frightened, miserably nervous as she was, the idea of turning back never occurred to her. She was only sorry that she hadn't put on her Venetian beads. They might have impressed Father Cassidy. Although Emily had never been to Whitecross, she knew the parish house when she saw it. A fine, tree-embowered residence near the big white chapel with a flashing gilt cross on its spire, and the 4 gilt angels, one on each of the little spires at the corners. Emily thought them very beautiful as they gleamed in the light of the lowering sun, and wished they could have some on the plain white church at Blair Water. She couldn't understand why Catholics should have all the angels. But there was not time to puzzle over this, for the door was opening, and the trim little maid was looking a question. "Is Father Cassidy at home?"
asked Emily, rather jerkily. "Yes. Can I see him?" "Come in," said the little maid. Evidently there was no difficulty about seeing Father Cassidy. No mysterious ceremony such as Emily had half expected, even if she were allowed to see him at all. She was shown into a book-lined room and left there, while the maid went to call Father Cassidy, who, she said, was working in the garden. That sounded quite natural and encouraging. If Father Cassidy worked in a garden, he could not be so very terrible. Emily looked about her curiously. She was in a very pretty room, with cozy chairs and pictures and flowers. Nothing alarming or uncanny about it, except a huge black cat who was sitting on the top of one of the bookcases. It was really an enormous creature. Emily adored cats, and had always felt at home with any of them, but she had never seen such a cat as this. What with its size and its insolent gold-hued eyes set like living jewels into its black velvet face, it did not seem to belong to the same species as nice, cuddly, respectable kittens at all. Mr. Dare would never have had such a beast about his manse. All Emily's dread of Father Cassidy returned. And then in came Father Cassidy, with the friendliest smile in the world. Emily took him in with her level gaze, as was her habit, or gift, and never again in the world was she the least bit afraid of Father Cassidy. He was big and broad shoulders, with brown eyes and brown hair, and his very face was so deeply tanned from his inveterate habit of going about bareheaded in merciless sunshine that it was brown too. Emily thought he looked just like a big nut. A big, brown, wholesome nut. Father Cassidy looked at her as he shook hands. Emily had one of her visitations of beauty just then. Excitement had brought a wild rose hue to her face. The sunlight brought out the watered silk gloss of her black hair. Her eyes were softly dark and limpid. But it was at her ears Father Cassidy suddenly bent to look. Emily had a moment of agonized wonder if they were clean. "She's got pointed ears," said Father Cassidy in a thrilling whisper. "Pointed ears! I knew she came straight from Fairyland the minute I saw her. Sit down, elf, if elves do sit. Sit down and give me the latest news of Titania's court." Emily's foot was now on her native heath. Father Cassidy talked her language, and he talked it in such a mellow, throaty voice, slurring his offs ever so softly as became a proper Irishman. But she shook her head a little sadly. With the burden of her errand on her soul, she could not play the part of ambassadress from Elfland. "I'm only Emily Starr of New Moon," she said, and then gasped hurriedly, because there must be no deception. No sailing under false colours. "And I'm a Protestant." "And a very nice little Protestant you are," said Father Cassidy. "But for sure I'm a bit disappointed. I'm used to Protestants. The woods hereabouts being full of them. But it's 100 years since the last elf called on me." Emily stared. Surely Father Cassidy wasn't 100 years old. He didn't look more than 50. Perhaps, though, Catholic priests did live longer than other people. She didn't know exactly what to say, so she said, a bit lamely, "I see you have a cat." "Wrong." Father Cassidy shook his head and groaned dismally. "A cat has me." Emily gave up trying to understand Father Cassidy. He was nice, but ununderstandable. She let it go at that, and she must get on with her errand. "You are kind of a minister, aren't you?" she asked timidly. She didn't know whether Father Cassidy would like being called a minister. "Kind of," he agreed amiably. "And you see, ministers and priests can't do their own swearing. They have to keep cats to do it for them. I never knew any cat that could swear as genteelly and effectively as the boy." "Is that what you call him?" asked Emily, looking at the black cat in some awe. It seemed hardly safe to discuss him right before his face. "That's what he calls himself. My mother doesn't like him because he steals the cream. Now, I don't mind his doing that. Oh, no, it's his way of licking his jaws after it that I can't stand.
Oh, boy, we've a fairy calling on us. Be excited for once, I implore you. There's a duck of a cat.
The boy refused to be excited. He winked an insolent eye at Emily. Have you any idea what goes on in the head of a cat, Elf? What queer questions, Father Cassidy asked. Yet Emily thought she would like his questions if she were not so worried. Suddenly Father Cassidy leaned across the table and said, Now, just what's bothering you?
I'm so unhappy,
said Emily piteously.
So are lots of other people.
Everybody is unhappy by spells. But creatures who have pointed ears shouldn't be unhappy. It's only mortals should be that.
Oh, please, please.
Emily wondered what she should call him. Would it offend him if a Protestant called him Father? But she had to risk it.
Oh, please, Father Cassidy, I'm in such trouble and I've come to ask a great favor of you.
Emily told him the whole tale from beginning to end. The old Murray Sullivan feud, her erstwhile friendship with Lofty John, the big sweet apple, the unhappy consequence, and Lofty John's threatened revenge. The boy and Father Cassidy listened with equal gravity until she had finished. Then the boy winked at her, but Father Cassidy put his long brown fingers together. He said. That's the first time, reflected Emily, that I've ever heard anyone outside of a book say, said Father Cassidy again.
And you want me to put a stop to this nefarious deed?
If you can, said Emily. Oh, it would be so splendid if you could. Will you?
Father Cassidy fitted his fingers still more carefully together.
I'm afraid I can hardly invoke the power of the keys to prevent Lofty John from disposing as he wishes of his own lawful property, you know, Elf.
Emily didn't understand the allusion to the keys, but she did understand that Father Cassidy was declining to bring the lever of the church to bear on Lofty John. There was no hope then. She could not keep the tears of disappointment out of her eyes.
Oh, come now, darling, don't cry, implored Father Cassidy. Elves never cry. They can't. It'd break my heart to discover you weren't of the green folk. You may call yourself of New Moon and have any religion you like, but the fact remains that you belong to the golden age and the old gods. That's why I must save your precious bit of greenwood for you.
Emily stared.
I think it can be done, Father Cassidy went on. I think if I go to Lofty John and have a heart-to-heart talk with him, I can make him see reason. Lofty John and I are very good friends. He's a reasonable creature, if you know how to take him, which means to flatter his vanity judiciously. I'll put it to him, not as priest to parishioner, but as man to man, that no decent Irishman carries on a feud with women, and that no sensible person is going to destroy for nothing but a grudge those fine old trees that have taken half a century to grow and can never be replaced. Why, the man who cuts down such a tree, except when it is really necessary, should be hanged as high as Haman on a gallows made from the wood of it.
Emily thought she would write that last sentence of Father Cassidy's down in Cousin Jimmy's blank book when she got home.
But I won't say that to Lofty John, concluded Father Cassidy. Yes, Emily of New Moon, I think we can consider it a settled thing that your bush will not be cut down.
Suddenly, Emily felt very happy. Somehow, she had entire confidence in Father Cassidy. She was sure he would twist Lofty John around his little finger.
Oh, I can never thank you enough, she said earnestly.
That's true, so don't waste breath trying. And now, tell me things. Are there any more of you? And how long have you been yourself?
I'm 12 years old. I haven't any brothers or sisters, and I think I'd better be going home.
Not till you've had a bite of lunch.
Oh, thank you. I've had my supper.
2 hours ago, and a 2-mile walk since. Don't tell me. I'm sorry I haven't any nectar and ambrosia on hand. Such food as elves eat, and not even a saucer of moonshine, but my mother makes the best plum cake of any woman in Prince Edward Island. And we keep a cream cow. Wait here a bit. Don't be afraid of the boy. He eats tender little Protestants sometimes, but he never meddles with leprechauns.
When Father Cassidy came back, his mother came with him, carrying a tray. Emily had expected to see her big and brown, too, but she was the tiniest woman imaginable, with snow-white silky hair, mild blue eyes, and pink cheeks.
"Isn't she the sweetest thing in the way of mothers?"
asked Father Cassidy. "I keep her to look at." "Of course," Father Cassidy dropped his voice to a pig's whisper, "there's something odd about her. I've known that woman to stop right in the middle of house cleaning and go off and spend an afternoon in the woods. Like yourself, I'm thinking she has some truck with fairies."
Mrs. Cassidy smiled, kissed Emily, said she must go out and finish her preserving, and trotted off.
"Now, you sit right down here, Elf, and be human for 10 minutes, and we'll have a friendly snack."
Emily was hungry, a nice, comfortable feeling she hadn't experienced for a fortnight. Mrs. Cassidy's plum cake was all her reverend son claimed, and the cream cow seemed to be no myth.
"What do you think of me now?"
asked Father Cassidy, suddenly finding Emily's eyes fixed on him speculatively. Emily blushed. She had been wondering if she dared ask another favor of Father Cassidy.
"I think you are awfully good," she said.
"I am awfully good," agreed Father Cassidy. "I'm so good that I'll do what you want me to do. For I feel there's something else you want me to do."
"I'm in a scrape, and I've been in it all summer. You see," Emily was very sober, "I am a poetess."
"Holy Mike, that is serious. I don't know if I can do much for you. How long have you been that way?"
"Are you making fun of me?"
asked Emily gravely. Father Cassidy swallowed something besides plum cake.
"The saints forbid. It's only that I'm rather overcome. To be after entertaining a lady of New Moon, and an elf, and a poetess all in one is a bit too much for a humble priest like myself. Have another slice of cake, and tell me all about it."
"It's like this. I'm writing an epic."
Father Cassidy suddenly leaned over and gave Emily's wrist a little pinch.
"I just wanted to see if you were real," he explained. "Yes, yes, you're writing an epic. Go on. I think I've got my second wind now."
"I began it last spring. I called it The White Lady first, but now I've changed it to The Child of the Sea. Don't you think that's a better title?"
"Oh, much better."
"I've got 3 cantos done, and I can't get any further because there's something I don't know and can't find out, and I've been so worried about it."
"Oh, what is it?"
"My epic," said Emily, diligently devouring plum cake, "is about a very beautiful high-born girl who was stolen away from her real parents when she was a baby and brought up in a woodcutter's hut."
"Oh, one of the 7 original plots in the world," murmured Father Cassidy.
"What?"
"Oh, nothing. Just a bad habit of thinking aloud. Go on."
"She had a lover of high degree, but his family did not want him to marry her because she was only a woodcutter's daughter."
"Another of the 7 plots. Oh, excuse me."
"So they sent him away to the Holy Land on a crusade, and word came back that he was killed. And then Editha, her name was Editha, went into a convent."
Emily paused for a bite of plum cake, and Father Cassidy took up the strain.
"And now her lover comes back very much alive, though covered with pain and scars, and the secret of her birth is discovered through the dying confession of the old nurse and the birthmark on her arm."
"How did you know?"
gasped Emily in amazement.
"Oh, I guessed it. I'm a good guesser. But where's your bother in all this?"
"I don't know how to get her out of the convent," confessed Emily. "I thought perhaps you would know how it could be done."
Again, Father Cassidy fitted his fingers.
"Let me see now. It's no light matter you've undertaken, young lady. How stands the case? Editha has taken the veil, not because she has a religious vocation, but because she imagines her heart is broken.
The Catholic Church does not release its nuns from their vows because they happen to think they've made a little mistake of that sort. No, 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 no. We must have a better reason. Is Editha the sole child of her parents, her real parents?
Yes.
Oh, then the way is clear. If she had had any brothers or sisters, you would have had to kill them off, which is a messy thing to do. Well, then, she is the sole daughter and heiress of a noble family who have for years been a deadly feud with another noble family, the family of the lover. Do you know what a feud is?
Of course, said Emily disdainfully. And I've got all that in the poem already.
So much the better. This feud has rent the kingdom in twain and can be only healed by an alliance between Capulet and Montague.
Those aren't their names.
No matter. This, then, is a national affair with far-reaching issues. Therefore, an appeal to the Supreme Pontiff is quite in order. What you want, Father Cassidy nodded solemnly, is a dispensation from Rome.
Dispensation is a hard word to work into a poem, said Emily.
Undoubtedly. But young ladies who will write epic poems and who will lay the scenes thereof amid times and manners of hundreds of years ago and will choose heroines of a religion quite unknown to them must expect to run up against a few snags.
Oh, I think I'll be able to work it in, said Emily cheerfully, and I'm so much obliged to you. You don't know what a relief it is to my mind. I'll finish the poem right up now in a few weeks. I haven't done a thing at it all summer. But then, of course, I've been busy. Ilsa Burnley and I have been making a new language.
Making a new... Excuse me? Did you say language?
Yes.
What's the matter with English? Isn't it good enough for you, you incomprehensible little being?
Oh, yes. That isn't why we're making a new one. You see, in the spring, Cousin Jimmy got a lot of French boys to help plant the potatoes. I had to help, too, and Ilsa came to keep me company. And it was so annoying to hear those boys talking French when we couldn't understand a word of it. They did it just to make us mad. Such jabbering! So Ilsa and I just made up our minds we'd invent a new language that they couldn't understand. We're getting on fine, and when the potato picking time comes, we'll be able to talk to each other, and those boys won't be able to understand a word we're saying. It'll be great fun.
I haven't a doubt. But two girls who will go to all the trouble of inventing a new language just to get square with some poor little French boys. You're beyond me, said Father Cassidy helplessly. Goodness knows what you'll be doing when you grow up. You'll be red revolutionists. I tremble for Canada.
Oh, it isn't a trouble. It's fun. And all the girls in school are just wild because they hear us talking in it and can't make it out. We can talk secrets right before them.
Human nature being what it is, I can see where the fun comes in, all right. Let's hear a sample of your language.
Nat Millen, o stay dolman, bote ta Shrewsbury fairness, ta poo litanos, said Emily glibly. That means, next summer, I am going to Shrewsbury Woods to pick strawberries. I yelled that across the playground to Ilsa the other day at recess. And, oh, how everybody stared.
Staring, is it? I should say so. My own poor old eyes are all but dropping out of my head. Let's hear a bit more of it.
Mo trowel de deed, seb at lead mu trainee. Mo betrowel seb mo ber trainee, da stended a ting cetra. That means, my father is dead, and so is my mother. My grandmother and grandfather have been dead a long time. We haven't invented a word for dead yet. I think I will soon be able to write my poems in our language, and then Aunt Elizabeth will not be able to read them if she finds them.
Have you written other poetry besides your epic?
Oh, yes, but just short pieces, dozens of them.
Would you be so kind as to let me hear one of them? Emily was greatly flattered, and she did not mind letting Father Cassidy hear her precious stuff.
I'll recite my last poem, she said, clearing her throat importantly. It's called Evening Dreams.
Father Cassidy listened attentively,
After the first verse, a change came over his big brown face, and he began patting his fingertips together. When Emily finished, she hung down her lashes and waited tremblingly. What if Father Cassidy said it was no good? No, he wouldn't be so impolite. But if he bantered her, as he had done about her epic, she would know what that meant. Father Cassidy did not speak all at once. The prolonged suspense was terrible to Emily. She was afraid he could not praise and did not want to hurt her feelings by dispraise. All at once her evening dreams seemed trash, and she wondered how she could ever have been silly enough to repeat it to Father Cassidy. Of course, it was trash. Father Cassidy knew that well enough. All the same, for a child like this, and rhyme and rhythm were flawless. And there was one line, just one line, the light of faintly golden stars. For the sake of that line, Father Cassidy suddenly said, "Oh, keep on writing poetry." "You mean," Emily was breathless, "I mean, you'll be able to do something by and by. Something, I don't know how much, but keep on, keep on." Emily was so happy she wanted to cry. It was the first word of commendation she had ever received except from her father, and a father might have too high an opinion of one. This was different. To the end of her struggle for recognition, Emily never forgot Father Cassidy's "keep on" and the tone in which he said it. "Aunt Elizabeth scolds me for writing poetry," she said wistfully. "She says people will think I'm as simple as Cousin Jimmy." The path of genius never did run smooth. But have another piece of cake. Do, just to show there's something human about you. "Ve, Mary T. Old El Rey Dolman Cosima Risem and Ritter." "That means, no thank you. I must be going home before it gets dark." "I'll drive you home." "Oh, no, no, it's very kind of you." The English language was quite good enough for Emily now. "But I'd rather walk. It's such good exercise." "Meaning," said Father Cassidy, with a twinkle in his eye, "that we must keep it from the old lady. Goodbye, and may you always see a happy face in your looking glass." Emily was too happy to be tired on the way home. There seemed to be a bubble of joy in her heart. A shimmering, prismatic bubble. When she came to the top of the big hill and looked across to New Moon, her eyes were satisfied and loving. How beautiful it was, lying embowered in the twilight of the old trees. The tips of the loftiest spruces came out in purple silhouette against the northwestern sky of rose and amber. Down behind it, the Blair Water dreamed in silver. The Wind Woman had folded her misty bat wings in a valley of sunset, and stillness lay over the world like a blessing. Emily felt sure everything would be all right. Father Cassidy would manage it in some way, and he had told her to keep on.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, part of the Zoomer Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. Discover more of Marilyn's readings, including Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Vanity Fair, Jane Eyre, and Anne of Green Gables at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also support this series by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review. Marilyn Lightstone Reads, beautiful stories, beautifully read for a crazy world.